I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's more evidence today that popular drugs used to treat depression may be doing some people more harm than good. A new study shows that adults taking the antidepressants Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft are twice as likely to attempt suicide than those who were given placebos. Dr. Dean Ferguson of the Ottawa Health Research Institute headed the mega study on these drugs, which are known as SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and he joins us on the line from his office. And Dr., tell us, how wide-ranging was your study?
To resolve the long-standing debate about whether there was a link with attempted suicide or suicidal behavior and the use of this class of drugs, we decided to look at the best quality evidence, that being randomized controlled trials. So we searched high and low for all the published clinical trials where SSRIs were evaluated. And we ended up identifying about 702 studies representing over 87,000 patients.
That's a lot of patients.
It is a lot of patients, but that's what's required when you have such a rare event or an uncommon event such as suicide attempt.
Yeah, because we should remind people that it is that uncommon, so a larger number would give you a better sense of how it occurs after taking these drugs. And what did you find? Did you find that there were patients who were more likely to react negatively to these drugs? Were these people, for instance, who were profoundly depressed anyway?
We found consistent effects across all patient groups, be it those with major depression, those with mild to moderate depression, and those with psychiatric disorders other than depression, such as obsessive compulsive disorder or panic disorder or sexual dysfunction.
Yeah. As you well know, one of your colleagues, the head of the University of Ottawa's psychiatric department, said he had concerns with your group's press release and at least how it's being interpreted. He says that a twofold increase is really a small number. Do you agree?
I agree. It is a small number, but we must keep in mind that these drugs are prescribed to many, many people. So with millions of prescriptions, that small number does get amplified. But he is correct that it is a small risk at the individual level. But it does become a public health concern because so many people are on these drugs.
And what would how might that number translate?
Well, it roughly equates to about an additional suicide attempt for every 1,000 patients.
That becomes a large number when you think of the millions who are taking the drugs.
That's the concern.
There are some critics who worry, though, that there are patients who might be on Zoloft or Paxil who might have responded that, yes, they did attempt suicide and that would be recorded in a study, but in fact they are doing fine now. Does that skew your results?
No, that could. That's a possible explanation. We can only go on with what was reported, that may be one explanation.
Well, what do you think should happen now, Doctor? As you know, the FDA last year found that many of these drugs increase suicidal thoughts and behaviors in children, and they've since required warning labels on the risks to children. What do you think should happen as the result of your study of adults?
Well, I think what is happening at the FDA level is they're evaluating the issue in adults now, and hopefully all the evidence to date will be incorporated. And if they see fit that a warning is suitable, then they'll do that. But I do stand by our evidence as the best to date, most conservative evidence to date.
So, Dr. Ferguson, mindful that you're a researcher and not a medical doctor, what do you think people should do based on your findings?
I'm not a medical doctor, and I cannot offer medical advice, but I think the key message that my colleagues have been saying, too, is that you certainly shouldn't come off your medications. It's just we need to reinforce close follow-up and monitoring of any symptoms that might be signs of increased agitation or restlessness. That's all.
Dr. Dean Ferguson was the lead investigator of a new study from the Ottawa Health Research Institute that showed people on antidepressants showed a twofold increase in a risk of suicide attempts. Dr. Ferguson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And a quick note on another drug. The Food and Drug Administration advisors have concluded today that the popular painkiller Celebrex does pose an increased risk for heart problems, but should remain on the market. Well, turning to news today from the Supreme Court, Chief Justice William Rehnquist will not be on the bench when the court resumes session next Tuesday. A court spokeswoman says the justice plans to skip the first 2 weeks of the session. Justice Rehnquist has been battling thyroid cancer and has been working from his home, but Tuesday's absence is bound to add to speculation that the 80-year-old might soon retire, paving the way for a new appointment. Now, when many people think of the U.S. Supreme Court, they see it in terms of conservative versus liberal, a delicate delicate yin-yang that can be disturbed by the appointment of a judge from either side. But in fact, the divide on the court may run in another direction. We're going to take a few minutes and go inside the Rehnquist court. What is the court's legacy? What are the chances of overturning Roe v. Wade? And what goes on behind closed doors? We'll get a little Supreme Court dish as well from Mark Tushnet. He's professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's the author of a new book entitled A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future Constitutional Law. And Professor Tushnet joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Explain what you mean by a court divided. You are not talking exclusively about conservatives and liberals.
No, there is a division between conservatives and liberals on the court, but the division that actually drives the court's decisions is a division, as I call it, between the court's modern or new breed Republicans, Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justices Scalia and Thomas on the one side, and more traditional Republicans like Justice David Souter or Sandra Day O'Connor on the other. The new breed or modern Republicans are the heirs of the Goldwater Ronald Reagan Party. They are conservative with respect to the size of the national government. They like smaller government. And they're conservative on the social issues like gay rights and abortion. The traditional Republicans are also suspicious of large bureaucratic government, but they are more tolerant and liberal on the social issues. So the effect of this is that when an economic regulation issue comes up, the Republicans are all united and the court takes a relatively conservative position. But when a social issue comes up, the traditional Republicans join with the liberals, and the outcome is what we see as a liberal decision.
Staying with the justices and who they are and how they're viewed, we want to start with the Chief Justice. At one point, you say that when Chief Justice Rehnquist first came to the court, his colleagues viewed him with relief in some ways because Chief Justice Berger was seen as pompous and a bumbling administrator. And Rehnquist, you write, was an affable ideologue.
The Chief Justice is an extremely friendly guy. He was appointed in 1971 or 72 by Richard Nixon. He was appointed in order to bring to the court what Nixon was calling a law and order perspective, what we would now call a general conservative perspective. He's been there for over 30 years, and he's been consistent in his conservatism. He's suspicious of the national government's power. He votes against affirmative action programs. It's in that sense that he's an ideologue. He's got a coherent conservative outlook that he brings consistently to bear on the decisions he faces.
Juxtaposed with the traditional Republicans, Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy. Let's stay with O'Connor. You write that in the eyes of some court observers, Sandra Day O'Connor might well be the most influential justice. Why is that?
The reason is that she is routinely in the middle of the court. There are, roughly speaking, three consistent conservatives and four consistent liberals, and then there's Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy. How they go determines the way the court goes. And Justice O'Connor seems somewhat more up for grabs.
You offer a lot of personal observations and one about O'Connor. When she says, oh, for goodness sakes, that usually means you've lost.
Oh, yes. She does have this verbal mannerism of saying, my goodness, why didn't your client do thus and so? Or my goodness, Bush against Gore, said, my goodness, it's certainly easy enough for people to read the instructions.
You devote another chapter to Anthony Kennedy. It's called Anthony Kennedy and Gay Rights. Now, he's a Reagan appointee. He wrote both of the key decisions in the Rehnquist era which protected gay rights, the most well-known being the ruling which overturned the Texas ban on sodomy. So is the read that he's a disappointment for Republicans?
Certainly in some sense. One of the things that happened when he was appointed in his first year or so, he was regarded as an extremely good conservative. But one thing that his supporters at that time didn't notice was that he had really from the beginning a fairly strong libertarian streak. A sense that the government just didn't have any business regulating the private sexual conduct of individuals. Mm.
Justice Clarence Thomas, after his tough confirmation hearings, he said, I'm going to be on this court for a long time. His critics say he hasn't done anything. But you write that what Thomas has done is maybe more interesting than what Scalia has done?
It's certainly the case that he's underestimated outside the court. Justice Thomas is much more, I would say, radical in his conservatism than Justice Scalia. And it's that that makes him interesting. He's willing to push the commitments of conservatives much farther than Justice Scalia is.
What about the sense that he was not qualified for the job that, again, some people have?
First of all, it wasn't the case, as President Bush, who nominated him, said, that he was the most qualified person in the country for the job. But it was also the case, contrary to what his opponents said, that he was qualified for the job. And we now know from more than 10 years of his work that he's performed perfectly fine. He doesn't ask questions from the bench. He says that that's because he doesn't feel any need to, as he would put it, show off for the public. He's basically raising a nephew, so he arrives at the court late and he leaves early to take his nephew to school and extracurricular events. He's not there all that often, but he gets the work done, and what he does has these sort of flashes of interesting stuff.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you write that by the time she got to the court, she was the Thurgood Marshall of gender equality law and has really made that her bailiwick.
She had been in private practice and as a law professor devoted to developing a legal strategy that would entrench women's rights in the Constitution. And then when she got to the Supreme Court, she wrote the court's opinion striking down sex-segregated education in a very strong opinion that is the vindication of her legal career.
We haven't touched on all the justices, and we're going to talk about the court as a whole in a moment, but is there anyone on the court that the others don't like? You know, is there any personal issue that's caught your eye?
Well, the primary personal conflict is between Antonin Scalia and almost everybody else, not actually Justice Ginsburg. She and Justice Scalia are actually fairly close personal friends. They have dinner together. My take on that is that they are both products of ethnic New York, and they're both extremely devoted to their families. And so they've bonded over those two attributes. But Justice Scalia has irritated almost everybody else on the court. Justice O'Connor seems to think of him as something of an intellectual bully, communicating that, as he put it in one of his opinions, her opinion couldn't be taken seriously. This is not language that's designed to endear you to the person you're writing about. He talks a lot at oral argument, and Chief Justice Rehnquist has occasionally interrupted him and said, just stop talking, let the lawyer say what he or she wants to say. So I think that's the primary source of friction, personal friction inside the court.
Mark Dushnet is author of A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. When we come back, some of the decisions the court has made and what might be in store for the future. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It was announced today that ailing Chief Justice William Rehnquist will not return to the bench when the court resumes session next week, taking at least two more weeks off. Well, we've been getting a Rehnquist court primer from author Mark Dushnet. His new book is called A Court Divided. And, Mark, we've been talking about individual justices, but let's look at the court as a whole. When Rehnquist was nominated in 1971, he had a very strong Republican resume. Put his appointment in context for us. How was the previous court under Chief Justice Warren Burger perceived?
When Rehnquist was appointed to the court, the constitutional law took its definition from the liberal Warren Court period. What that meant was that there was sort of a presumption that the national government had a lot of power to regulate the economy and to promote civil rights, but that you had to be very cautious when governments intruded on what seemed to be personal liberty. So there was sort of a presumption against intrusions on liberty. That was in 1971. Over the course of Rehnquist's career, those presumptions haven't been reversed. It's not that the presumption is the national government doesn't have power to regulate or that intrusions on liberty are okay. It's just that you have to look at these cases one by one on a sort of even playing field.
We want to look at some of the cases, but, you know, to give it an overarching look, you've warned us against dividing this court, Democrat, Republican, left, right. But even so, I'm going to ask you, if you could tick off the decisions that the court made that veered it in either direction and maybe jockeyed it back and forth.
The Rehnquist court's more liberal decisions are decisions upholding affirmative action programs, reaffirming the core holding of Roe and Wade, striking down restrictions on gays, the Texas anti-sodomy statute. Those are the main liberal decisions of the Rehnquist court. The more conservative decisions of the court are decisions upholding the power of government to use vouchers at religiously affiliated schools, restrictions on environmental regulation of private property, a decision saying that Congress can regulate only commercial matters and assaults on women based on their gender aren't commercial matters. Those are probably the main conservative decisions of the court.
You say in the beginning of the book that the way to really understand, or I guess the hardest but most important part of the story of the Rehnquist court, is figuring out what conservatism about the Constitution is, your sentence. I mean, how it was interpreted by those who would loosely interpret the Constitution, or Scalia, for instance, who was hardcore about, you know, it means exactly what it says. So when you looked at these decisions, who did win more decisions, the hardcore interpreters of the Constitution or those who think that issues change with time?
I think overall what you'd say about the Rehnquist court is that if you look at the outcomes of the decisions, they are on balance mostly conservative decisions, not on key social issue matters, but overall it's a conservative court. If you look at how the court did it, what it means to interpret the Constitution right. In a conservative way, it turns out that the conservatives are pretty much as dedicated as the liberals are to interpreting the Constitution, to accomplish what they think is important, to be, in a word, activist, but on the conservative side rather than on the liberal side.
But still, probably not as conservative an interpretation of the Constitution as some, Justice Scalia comes to mind, would like.
Certainly the court, if you look at both its outcomes and its techniques, has not followed a hardline, extreme conservative position. Justice Thomas is a consistent original understanding person.
Original understanding meaning that the original meaning of the Constitution applies today.
Applies today. He would interpret the Constitution today to mean what it meant in 1789, and nobody else is willing to go along with him on that.
What do you think the legacy of the Rehnquist court will be?
I think there are two ways to describe the legacy of the Rehnquist court. One is that it shifted the terrain. The playing field is now just very different.
As we said earlier, the decisions aren't as black and white. It's a case-by-case court.
The other way to describe it is that in changing the terrain, the Rehnquist court brought the constitutional law to the threshold of a number of doors that it might walk through. Serious restrictions on the national government's power to protect the environment. They haven't done it yet. The next court, the
overturning Roe v. Wade, for instance?
Overturning Roe is a possibility. The doctrines in play are not entirely in place there. My own prediction is that that's not going to happen for at least 5 to 10 years. It might happen after that, but 5 to 10 years in Supreme Court history is a very long time. Mm-hmm. The Rehnquist court made things possible that didn't seem possible 15 to 20 years ago. These possibilities might be realized by a successor court. But the court might go on, as it has been, sort of drifting gradually in a more conservative direction rather than dramatically revolutionizing constitutional law.
As the moderate on the court, I'm thinking of Sandra Day O'Connor, Kennedy, keep tacking the sails as it drifts along.
That's right. I mean, what's happened on the court is that the moderates have exercised a restraining influence on the movement to the right. were one or both of them to leave the court and to be replaced by these new breed Republicans of the sort that President Bush is likely to want to appoint, the restraining force would be taken off and the chance of a substantial and fairly rapid transformation in constitutional law would be a real one.
Mark Tushnet is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's author of The Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. Professor Tushnet, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, in case you missed it, it was announced just today that the ailing William Rehnquist will not be on the bench when the court reconvenes next Tuesday. He's taking 2 weeks off. Next week on Here and Now, political correctness on campus and calls for Harvard President Lawrence Summers to resign. Also, everything you were not taught in school about the U.S. presidents. That's next week. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Next week, the faculty of Harvard University will meet to continue a passionate conversation about the leadership of the school's president, Lawrence Summers. A heated meeting between faculty and president this week increased speculation that the professors could take a vote of no confidence in Summers. The firestorm ignited after remarks that Summers made last month at a conference about women in the sciences. Today, he released a transcript of those comments. To sum up, Summers said he was inclined to favor biology over discrimination and social factors as the reason why fewer women scientists rise to the top. His exact words, "In the special case of science and engineering, there are issues of intrinsic aptitude, and particularly of the variability of aptitude, and that those considerations are reinforced by what are in fact lesser factors involving socialization and continuing discrimination." He also called for research into the issue. So, should Summers resign, as some are saying? Here's a sampling from Harvard's campus.
Even though it was a very negative thing that he said, I think that the consequences of it have been a positive awareness, like a national awareness of the lack of women being like represented fairly in the science fields.
Even if they were true, it probably wasn't the smartest thing to say them, but it's just the faculty, you know, blowing a whole long list of dirty laundry at them in one meeting and trying to get as much out of it as they can.
It is somewhat deserved, and he should be reprimanded somewhat for the comments he made. However, all this talk of forcing him to resign and signing a petition to see him leave the university, I think it's a bit overblown.
In a way, it's good that it was brought up and is now such a heated debate. But I do think that Larry Summers was out of line. I mean, he's the president of Harvard. Okay, so he wasn't acting in his official capacity, whatever. But he's still the president of Harvard. And to even sort of make the suggestion that maybe women are innately bad at science is just ludicrous.
The thoughts today of some Harvard students. Well, Karen McTighe Musel runs the Office of Diversity at the Association of American Colleges and Universities in Washington, and Here Now's Bob Oakes spoke with her about the Summers controversy.
Let me ask you, first of all, Doctor, President Summers, Harvard President Summers, has generated controversy since he took office at Harvard in 2001. In the world of academia beyond Harvard, how is his leadership style perceived?
He is known as a very bright, quick-tongued, and often shoots from the hip, which can get him in a little bit of trouble, and I think did when he was Secretary of Treasury here. And I know at the academic conferences I've been to in the last 4 weeks, when Larry Summers' name is mentioned from the podium, there has been either an audible collective groan or a great deal of snickering. Now, I think for Harvard, that's a little bit like being in the opening rift in a Jay Leno sequence, and I think that most people at Harvard don't like to have that happen to them, because he has made gaffes before, but this one really touched a nerve, and I think it puts some of the things Harvard wants to do, recruit women, be seen as taking women seriously, recruit people to the science departments, that all of that has been put in some jeopardy because of this remark.
Well, step back for a moment, if you would, to look at the role of a university president. In your opinion, is Lawrence Summers overstepping the bounds that prescribe how a college president is to behave and speak in public?
Well, I think that, people expect a lot of their president, and they expect presidents like the rest of us to make mistakes and to make fools of ourselves, and I think to do something like he has done. And I think he certainly made a mistake, and I think that people are calling him to account on that. I think the real question, however, will be how he responds as a leader now that he has understood the depth of the seriousness of his mistake.
President Summers apologized for his comments on Tuesday, as he's done previously. He's been meeting with faculty members talking about this issue. Why isn't all that enough to quiet calls for his resignation, do you think?
Well, I think there's two things at work. One, I think, is the seriousness of his remark, and I don't think we can, overemphasize that, because he fell into a kind of default thinking that I believe is readily available to many Americans, and that is that biology is what explains the discrimination of marked groups, in this case, of women's lack of advancement in science. And we know that science has in the past promulgated similar notions, typically to justify continued exclusion. And so many people, if you were African American, you remember that it was science that ruled you were a subhuman species and therefore could be treated as chattel. If you were a Jew, you knew that science had marked you as this subspecies that could be justified to be exterminated. And of course, if you're a woman, you realize that science in the past has ruled you as some sort of deficient man. In fact, at the height of a debate about coeducation at Harvard in the late 19th century, a professor there, a Dr. Edward Clark, used medical science to explain that a woman who used her brain too much would shrink her uterus. And so this is the most hilarious kinds of thing. But the book he published, Sex and Education, went through 17 printings. So at the time, this kind of medical science was legitimate in some quarters and continued to be the explanation for why colleges and universities should not admit women. And for many women, they believed that this might happen to them. So on the one hand, there is the seriousness of this. And on the other hand, this has obviously fed into other kinds of unrest that faculty and displeasure that faculty have with Summers' leadership.
Quick answer to the last question, Doctor, if you would. A prediction here. Is this a controversy going to rapidly go away or linger on for a while at Harvard?
I think it will linger. I think even if he does get, as some people are predicting he might, a no-confidence voice from the faculty, that may not be definitive. I think what really matters is what he does in the next several months. And I do think the key thing at Harvard is, even if Larry Summers loses his job, that they, as an institution, must take care not to abandon the unfinished business of gender equity.
Karen McTighe-Musel is Vice President of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Global Initiatives at the Association of American Colleges and Universities. She's also co-director of the National Initiative on Women in Higher Education. She spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Well, what are your thoughts? As always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And you can mail us the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and the town you're from. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. This Sunday marks the two-year anniversary of the Rhode Island Station nightclub fire, which killed 100 people. Dozens of survivors are still struggling with the physical, emotional, and financial consequences of the fire, and there are ongoing criminal and civil cases. And families of victims have also been struggling with another question. Why didn't the deaths of their loved ones lead to more changes in fire safety across the country? Here in Massachusetts, before the curtain goes up, theatergoers are now greeted with this announcement.
Massachusetts law requires us to inform you that in the unlikely event of an emergency, you may be instructed to evacuate the theater. Please take a moment to locate the exits. Ushers are standing by to assist you in an emergency.
But is that enough? David Lucht, a professor at the Center for Fire Safety Studies at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, thinks it is not. And David joins us. And David, we all saw the images from the station fire, people unable to get outdoors and windows. Why do you think there hasn't been more change?
I really think it's a cultural thing. I use drunk driving as an example. 10, 20, 30 years ago, driving after drinking alcohol was much more socially acceptable. And today that's changed. Mothers Against Drunk Driving and other grassroots groups have just said, we've had enough. We want change. We want drunk drivers to be held accountable. And we haven't had that kind of groundswell of insistence.
Well, we know that there are people who are trying on a national level. There's a bill that's been introduced to provide tax incentives to nightclubs that install sprinklers, but that's stalled in Congress. And many states are trying to push through legislation to make requirements tougher for sprinklers and to remove grandfather clauses. But a lot of these get stalled. And then also, many states are having budget cuts, so they have fewer and fewer inspectors, for instance. How do you overcome something like that? I mean, it seems like this is at a high policy level that changes have to be made.
You're absolutely right. The high policy level changes are needed. And one of the things that's happening in other countries is building owners are required to engage third-party licensed inspectors, putting more of a burden on the owners of the larger, higher-risk properties to have experts come in and check things out for them. So there are creative ways of trying to reduce that budget problem.
Well, that raises the question, though. People pay a lot of money for their insurance, and they expect insurance companies to do more. And I'm wondering if you think the insurance industry should have a bigger role to play. In an unusual suit, the Station Nightclub fire plaintiffs are suing an insurer of the club for failing to adequately inspect the club.
Yeah, that is a complicated question. The insurance industry used to play a much larger role in inspecting buildings than they do today. And it's more complicated because the type of coverage offered by the insurance industry is both fire insurance and liability. The fire inspectors are looking for reducing property damage risks. The real problem I think we're talking more about is the life safety risks.
Yeah. Well, meantime, individuals are taking matters into their own hands. There's an inn right across the street from the Station nightclub. They watched that fire unfold that night. Now they have evacuation plans posted on their walls. They have a diagram of the restaurant on the back of menus. And also the father of one of the fire victims, tired of inaction on a government level, has formed a group, Parents Involved in Nightclub Safety, to push for some of this legislation that seems to be stalled. Do you think it's going to be individuals who are going to be able to push some sort of new fire safety awareness?
Yeah, I think grassroots efforts really do make a difference. You mentioned earlier that public venues are announcing fires, making fire safety announcements at the beginning of a performance, explaining where the exits are, kind of like they do in airplanes. And I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And as we see more public announcements made about safety in places of public assembly, it'll become more on the conscience of owners and attendees as well.
Well, every time I hear it at a theater or a club here in Boston, I think of the station, nightclub, and that's not a bad thing.
That's right. At least that is a benefit from the tragedy.
David Lucht is a professor at the Center for Fire Safety Studies at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts. David, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Stay with us. An unusual trek is coming up. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the wake of the Indian Ocean tsunami, one of the more startling images was that of near-naked indigenous peoples from the Andaman and Nicobar Islands off of India greeting aid workers with bows and arrows. It's illegal to approach these tribal peoples. They're protected by the Indian government because of fears of the spread of disease and westernization, of their ancient primitive culture. Well, an American tour guide named Kelly Wolford says people have a right to see these tribes, and he's been advertising online what he calls first contact treks. Writer Michael Bihar made a trek earlier this year to West Papua, Indonesia, and he described it in the February issue of Outside Magazine, and he joins us on the line now. And Michael, how does this guide, Kelly Wolford, how does he find these uncontacted tribes?
Well, that's a good question. That was one of the first things I asked him when I was researching the legitimacy of this whole thing, which I kind of always went into with a good healthy dose of skepticism. But he's been to the area, I think, almost 25 times. He knows it very well. He speaks the language very well. So he puts the word out to sort of the more remote villages, but ones that are in contact with the outside world, that he is interested in finding out the whereabouts of tribes that aren't known about.
You found yourself going into the jungle. Can you just tell us what happened when there was first a sense that there was something that was unknown to you in the jungle with you?
Well, we had taken a boat about a day's trip up river. It reminded me sort of that Apocalypse Now scene where you're going up river day after day, and we had hiked in probably 5 hours or so. And one of our porters had gone ahead to sort of scout the route the next day, and he came back sort of excited and a little bit freaked out that he had come across these men in the jungle, eight of them, who were sort of startled by his presence, and he was startled by theirs, and they sort of went their separate ways very quickly. But he really wanted us to go back the next day and try to see these guys.
Tell us about your actual encounter. You write that you were walking, you smelled smoke, it was the campfire of the native party.
Yeah, we walked about 15 minutes from our sort of bush shelter camp, and the jungle, surprisingly, has absolutely no smell. So the campfire we smelled sort of struck us right away. And right after that, our guides will call out. They make sort of a hollering sound in the jungle.
And what does that sound like?
The sound they would make sort of went, woo-ah, woo-ah, and then they would wait. And technically, you're supposed to get a response, or you're not supposed to approach. Well, we didn't get a response, and at the time, I didn't know this. But anyway, they did this, and we proceeded in forward, and we sort of got close enough to where we could smell this campfire, and you could sort of see a little small shelter built in the jungle. And immediately after that, the men who were in there sort of jumped up and went fleeing into the forest, sprinting and basically screaming and yelling at the top of their lungs.
And raising their bows and sort of pulling their bows back?
Yeah, they disappeared in the jungle pretty quickly. They surrounded us in sort of a circle of maybe 50 to 75 yards in diameter. And then they would sort of pop out from behind trees at all different directions, in front and back, beside. And they would pull and release their bow. They usually would have an arrow in it, but the arrow would stay between their fingers.
Mm.
And the bow would release. So they would be actually aiming an arrow at you.
I could kill you if I wanted to.
Exactly. And they certainly could. These guys can shoot birds out of the sky with these bows and arrows. I mean, there's no question that we would have all been dead in 15 seconds had they wanted to kill us.
What did they look like?
Well, they were all pretty healthy-looking guys. All, you know, they were wearing sort of these wigs that looked a little bit like dreadlocks in a way. And then they had no shirts on. Some of them had white paint on their chests and foreheads. Mm-hmm. Then they had some armbands on that were made of bright yellow leaves, very thin leaves. They're quite pretty. And grass skirts, almost just like a hula skirt, you would mm-hmm. imagine, but also made of the same yellow leaves. Mm-hmm. And then their bows and arrows. And the bows and arrows aren't the kind you think of an archer using in the Olympics. They are enormous. They're 6 feet tall.
Well, this was a frightening experience for you and your companions. Could you sense what it was like for them?
Well, yeah. We noticed that two or three of them, their hands were shaking quite a bit. And that, to me, seemed like they were pretty terrified. So at that point, we backed off, and then they ran off into the jungle again a couple more times. They actually ran away, and one of our porters tried to get them to come back. And then as we all sort of hiked back to camp, there was between myself and the photographer and the other client sort of talked about it and how we were feeling a little bit like we had trespassing in a way that was sort of inherently wrong.
As terrifying as that was for you, and it sounds like for them, there was yet to be another encounter. You're encamped by the river, and suddenly you hear shouts and people yelling.
I came out of the tent kind of not really expecting the eight men to be literally 2 feet from me running straight at me. With bows and arrows, yes. So I sort of took off in the opposite direction, which happened to be over the edge of the riverbank, scurried sort of downriver and up sort of behind where they had come into our camp. And this time it was a little strange. When I came back up from my position down on the river, the tribesmen had come into the camp, but this time they were a lot less scared. In fact, they didn't show any fear at all. And they weren't really being aggressive. They weren't really saying much. It was very strange. They were just sort of standing around, not really looking like they knew what to do with themselves. The photographer, Stephen, fortunately, just grabbed his camera and walked straight up to him and started taking photos. Mm. And I had the video camera, and I was shooting video. And this maybe went on for a minute or two, and then they did their usual suddenly starting to panic and run to the jungle again. But this time they sort of came back on their own a couple of times.
You obviously eventually pack your gear and leave. And I'm just wondering, and they also leave, obviously, but you have the pictures, you have the tape. But what do you take away from this? Was this a real encounter? Was this your tour guide setting up an encounter? What was it?
It's almost impossible to know. When I got home and we started to show the video to anthropologists who'd studied in the area and done work there, they started to point out things in the video that they thought were really suspicious. You know, things like these guys were, you know, wearing their ceremonial dress while supposedly out hunting in the forest. That's pretty unusual. They wouldn't be really wearing these clothes. They also pointed out the fact that the men didn't have any skin diseases. Things like ringworm are absolutely rampant among everybody there. In fact, even I was only there 4 days, and I looked like I had chicken pox.
But then you spoke to other anthropologists who said what?
Well, none of the anthropologists would really give me 100% yes, it's fake. That, you know, no one could do that unless they really went and were there. Some of them were, you know, noticed that the other porters seemed frightened.
And you also caught those porters on the videotape when they didn't know they were being taped, telling your guide that they were frightened.
Exactly, yeah. We obviously, the porters were speaking in Indonesian, and when I got home, I had everything the porters said on and off camera, even when they didn't know it was running, translated. And they're talking to each other about being scared, you know, worried that, you know, one of them says, I think they're going to come in the night and attack us, and I think we should leave now. No, we should leave tomorrow. You know, what you'd expect them to be saying if it was real. So, again, there isn't really much a dispute that there probably are tribes living in this part of the world that haven't had contact with outsiders. One of the anthropologists I interviewed said to me, sure, you could find uncontacted tribes in West Papua. You're not going to find them in 4 days, but if you want to walk 3 weeks in mud up to your waist, they're there. But Kelly originally was talking about First Contact Tribe as a tribe that has not only never actually seen an outsider, but is not even aware of the outsider's existence. And no one I talked to said that's even possible. The tribes know of outsiders. They just don't interact with them, or they haven't in several generations.
Michael Bihar, a contributor for Outside Magazine. Michael, thanks for talking to us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.